How's it? My name is Lassetti. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it?
Oh, trust me. It can see you.
There, between the trees.
It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk.
I guess not everyone is taken to the right places, but you will be if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel. Explore.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So the South American expedition was born out of a group of us all just getting together and in a pub and getting drunk and thinking wildly and, you know, and suddenly coming up, let's go to South America. Let's go for 9 months because we can't afford going backwards and forwards.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Brian Hall. Brian is a climber and mountaineer and a qualified mountain guide and author. He's been a key figure on the big mountain scene and has carried out expeditions to some of the bigger and bolder mountains of the world, including Mount Everest in winter, K2, Jannu, Nuptse, Makalu, Baltoro Kangri, Shivling, the Ogatu and peaks throughout the Andes. The list goes on and on. He's a mountaineer's mountaineer and has had a sensational career, often shying away from the fame and glory that often comes with climbing at that level. He's just released a book about the golden age of Himalayan mountaineering in the 70s and 80s, and we go into that in detail in this episode. Okay, over to Brian Hall. So I think a logical, obvious place to start would be just to introduce yourself. Tell me who you are, what you do, and what your life involves.
Okay. My name's Brian Hall, and I'm a mountaineer, I guess. I've been a mountaineer all my life. Started climbing when I was 16 in the Lake District. I then went to Leeds University, where I arrived really as quite a Mr. Average climber. And suddenly I was hanging on to the coattails of all these amazing climbers like John Syrett and et cetera. Suddenly I was climbing routes that were beyond my dreams then. I left Leeds and then went to Bangor University to study ecology. I studied geography at Leeds. And at Bangor, I fell in with a group of mountaineers. And just progressed from really rock climbing in Britain and snow and ice climbing in Scotland to the Alps and then to the greater ranges. And certainly through my 20s into my 30s, I was just a mountaineer. I did nothing else. I hadn't got a job. I had partners occasionally. I had no car. I had no phone. I was a dirt bag basically, who just, you know, went around the world climbing. And I was part of a group really that probably had its roots in many ways in Leeds. But a lot of the people who were at Leeds University had friends of friends, and we all formed a very loose group through. This is the 1970s and the 1980s. And then really, I guess, there would be a time when I felt as though I should finish mountaineering. And we're going to talk about that more later. But really, in the mid-80s, several things happened. A lot of my friends had died, and I became dissatisfied with going into the mountains. At a high level, but I still continued climbing, and I qualified as a mountain guide and started guiding in the Alps. I moved to Chamonix and lived in Chamonix for 8 years, climbing constantly. But I got, I guess, fed up with just taking people up the same old routes, because I'd been used to doing lots of different things, exciting things. And so there became an opportunity to work with the film industry, providing safety for film crews going into the mountains. And I just thought that was wonderful. It was great. Every job was different. It was really exciting. And also, to be honest, it was quite well paid compared to sort of the average day-to-day climbing Mont Blanc, for example. And that really was my main thing that I did, really, through the late 90s, right the way through to COVID. And then at COVID, everything stopped, combination of Brexit. And I decided, now that I'd just reached 70, it was time to hang up my boots and retire. So I'm officially retired now. And during that time, I did all sorts of diversions. Along with John Porter, a fellow mountaineer who I climbed with, we set up the Candle Mountain Film Festival in 1980. And we ran three of those in 80, 81 and 83. And then we decided that, God, this is too much hard work. We'll go back to climbing. So we went back to climbing. And in 1999, people were saying, well, where's Kendall gone? We really loved it. So we reinstated Kendall and we ran it every year until 2008, when we thought, oh, no, we've just had enough of this. And we turned it into a community interest charity, and gave it to a new team of people, who some of them are still running it, but we still have strong ties with that. So I got very, very involved, not only in the safety issue of making films, but also in the showing of the films, I guess. And during that time, for example, the Candle Mountain Film Festival became the second biggest film festival in Britain after London, of any film festival. And we got to have it audited to get grants. And we brought in £1 million worth of turnover into the Kendal Southern Lake District economy for every festival. And I think that really, you know, continues today. So I think it's I find it quite a nice legacy to sit back and think about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'll tell you this story in person one day, but I can personally thank the Kendal Mountain Festival for getting me into the industry. I sat in that audience and fell in love with mountain film in that theatre. So thanks. But if you know, going back to the very, very early days of your climbing, you know, age 16, right back at the start, what was it that gripped you and that pulled you in and that got you so hooked?
It's a very difficult memory, you know, thinking back. And one of the reasons I've just finished writing this book called High Risk Climbing to Extinction. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write that book was that I realized that my memory of a lot of things 40, 50 years ago was getting rather jumbled up and a bit vague. And I wanted to revisit that time and try and remember the whys and the ifs and who I did it with. It was a fantastic, unbelievable experience writing the book, talking to people, ringing up people who I haven't met, or arranging to meet in pubs people I hadn't met for 30 and 40 years. And it was so enlightening and so powerful to do that. And one of the things was remembering, really starting when I was 16. And I started with my mate Sam Cochran, who was born on the same day as me. We had similar tastes in music, we both liked wandering around the hills in our spare time as 15 and 16 year olds. And then one of our school teachers, a Mr. Causey, Jeff Causey, said, well, why don't you come out? We're going to go out in winter, and you'll just have to have a bit more, you know, tuition about what you're going to do in winter, because we're going to go up this gully, which was called Heart of Fell Gully in Kentmere. So we had these crampons and ice axes, and we had to put a rope on. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I did three winter climbs that winter. I climbed snow and ice before I went rock climbing. But then very naturally, we went with a group of Jeff's friends, who were a lot older, to Lamberis Pass and did my first rock climbing, which was the Wrinkle, on the Wasted, I think it is. I just found it so powerful, and the feeling. I was quite good at cricket and I was quite good at rugby, but the team game suddenly didn't give me that self-confidence and elation that doing a climb did. And so I became hooked, and Sam and I climbed together, and I'd always remember the first rock route that we did together, which was Beaufell Buttress, just at the head of the Langdale Valley. And it was a multi-pitch climb. And we felt totally out of our depths. You know, think just like reading a guidebook and trying to translate that onto a lump of rock. When you had somebody there telling you what to do and pointing, it was so much easier. But just doing it by yourself. And I always remember that because you don't actually become a proper climber and a proper mountaineer until you do it yourself. It's all right being guided. Yes, it's a nice time. You have a good time in the mountain. But you have to get away from everybody else with your mate, go out and do something with yourself, with nobody there saying, do this, do that. And we looked at this crag. Where the hell do we climb? And then we read these words, and it didn't seem, go up a corner to a ledge. Where lots of corners and lots of ledges. Anyway, we got to the top, and we were so made up. It was as though we'd played in the FA Cup final. You know, it was that sort of elation. And from then on, we were just hooked. We took a steam train. You know, this engine with steam. It's that long ago, and the compartments were all. You know, the carriages were all compartments, all the way up to Skye, and Skye just felt like the biggest mountains in the world, and yeah, we were frightened because we were there by ourselves. But in doing that, that was another step on the ladder to becoming proficient and enlightened by the mountains, and not only that, by doing that, you go on a journey. And I think that mountaineering, from right that start, is a journey. And you can only do that journey if you do it by yourself. The journey is you're packing your gear. You have to be reliant on that. You find out where to go. You look at and study the route. And you're on the route yourself, and you have to make your own decisions about the weather forecast. And it's just the same whether you're doing Beaufell Buttress, the Keok in the sky, or whether you're climbing a major Himalayan peak. Unless you take that journey, and if you shortcut that journey, your experience is severely diminished.
I'd say that sums it up pretty well. Better than most, actually. It's hard to argue with that. And, back then, were you always... Did you have your eyes fixed on the greater ranges and the bigger hills, or did that come later?
I didn't have my eyes fixed on the greater ranges, for sure. There was nothing. There was no way. I was a very much Mr. Average. I was frightened on V diffs. You know, I actually climbed better on ice, and that probably continued all the way through my life. You know, I could do a grade 3 ice climb before I could do a VS, for example. And so I started from that sort of background. And I must say that my development as a climber was a series of steps. I was never looking at a big mountain and thinking I will get there. And all the stories of what was happening, for example, the story of Bonington's South Face of Annapurna in 1970, I think it was, was something I read and found interest in reading, but never ever thought that I'd go there or do that. And yet 5 or 6 years later, that had changed. But it changed because of a series of steps and because of a series of people who were influencing me. And I don't know many climbers or mountaineers who haven't progressed without the aid of mates or mentors. And that was very certainly my my experience. So when I went to Leeds, my best mate Sam, who we climbed together, we were born on the same day. We went to university to the same. We ended up sharing a house together. We even ended up sharing girlfriends occasionally. So we were like twins. But what a strange thing happened was that we went down to Bosigrin, Cornwall, and we had a car accident, and Sam was really badly injured. And Sam was like a really, we were identical in our wanting to adventure, and that completely changed his outlook. So he never climbed again after that. And it was a looking back on it, it was an example of post-traumatic stress. You know, although post-traumatic stress wasn't defined until 1980 and was nearly always labelled for the military, now I believe post-traumatic stress actually happens to a lot of mountaineers and climbers and people in other ways of life. For example, in motor accidents, a third of people who have motor accidents suffer from post-traumatic stress. And so I was then, Sam not disappeared from my life, but wasn't my partner. So I joined the Leeds University Mountaineering Club, and it was such a vibrant club. People, you know, the people who perhaps listeners will remember on the names of, for example, I climbed an awful lot with John Syrett. I climbed an awful lot with John Stainforth, Bernard Newman, Roger Baxter Jones. A lot of these people were, you know, far better than me. And it was only by them tying onto the end of their ropes and then pushing me that I progressed within a year from struggling on VSs to doing, you know, extremes then. They weren't E1s or E2s or E3s. But and then suddenly, are you going to go to the Alps? My God, you know. And I'd never dreamed of ever being going to the Alps. And we went to the Alps and off we go.
Yeah, and before we get into all of that, I'm fascinated by the journey and what happened to all of you. But, you know, you've said it was kind of the mid-70s to the 80s where you were coming in. What was the legacy that you'd been left by the generation before? What was the state of mountaineering when you were getting into it?
Okay, well, I think that it was in a massive state of flux, I believe, on all counts. And so what we went into, both in rock climbing, in ice climbing and mountaineering, all of them were dramatically changing in the beginning of the 70s. If we just take the simple one of rock climbing, I think that the rock climbing had probably stagnated a little bit after the Browns, Willands type of era. And there was still a movement to still pull on aid or rest. He still done a climb if you'd rested on it. You know, it was that sort of ethos. And also, but what helped was that time there was a big increase in the way that climbs could be protected. I started with hand machine nuts on a sling. And by the time I was at university, 3 or 4 years later, there were actually MOACs, there was wire nuts, there was aluminium carabiners, there was harnesses. When I started climbing in 1966, I was on a hemp waistline with slings and a hawser-laid rope. By the time I was at university, there was a lot different protection. There was nuts. In that, only in 5 years. But also the ethics. We had John Syrett, for example, had the ethic that if he had to rest on a route, if he had to inspect a route, or if he had to use aids on the route, he hadn't done it. And that was new in that period. And John was one of the leading people, not only in his ability, but in his idea that he would, that was what was going to happen in rock climbing. And by the time I was in 1972, 73, really, you know, the maximum that people climbed in the present day was really E3 6A. That was the hardest that was the hardest routes, really, which seems pitiful to think now, that the best climbers of the day, and certainly I wasn't climbing at that level. I was probably climbing at, you know, getting up what would be regarded as E1s, you know, today, perhaps a few E2s. So there was a big change. By the way, there was no CAMS by then. No CAMS. CAMS came at the end of the decade. So gritstone climbing was a lot harder, and we were doing a lot of gritstone climbing because obviously we were at Leeds, and limestone. But the limestone, a lot of it was protected by pegs then. In winter climbing, it was right at the time when I first started ice climbing, or snow climbing or whatever, I had a wooden ice axe and I had crampons with no front points. There was no ice screws. Within 5 or 6 years, two things happened. One thing happened, the development of gear, but it happened in two ways. Johnny Cunningham passed the idea of curving the pick of an ice axe, so it hooked better on ice when you banged it in. And Chouinard looked at this and developed commercially the idea of curved picks. At the same time, he also put on front points, which had been experimented by people like in Austria, like Welsenbach. So it wasn't all just, you know, like Chouinard said, he's the father of all this. He commercialized it, but Welsenbach perhaps with his front points and Johnny Cunningham with the curves had the ideas before. And at the same time, over on this side of the Atlantic in Scotland, Hamish McInnes developed his prototype pterodactyl. Rather than a curve, it was a sharp thing. Now, that really revolutionized, and within 5 years, people were starting to repeat routes that had never been repeated. You know, the classic, just rewind here. So Marshall and Smith were unbelievably good climbers, Scottish climbing, do many, many of the hardest Scottish routes of the day. They break through into the grade 5 level at that time, but they were using straight ice axes. They were cutting steps. And so nobody else had the ability to do that. And it was only a few years later where people started doing the second ascents and third ascents and then progressing to grade 5. And I was involved in that in a strange sort of, I was involved in it because I was with the people who were doing it. We'll talk about that. Remind me to, we'll talk about that in a minute. But that what was also happening in the Scottish winter ice climbing. Sorry, it wasn't just in Scotland. It was happening in the Alps as well. You know, it was happening in Alaska and Colorado. We're not just talking about, you know, jingoistically like, hey, it's just Britain. And then in mountaineering terms, 1975 was the watershed year, which we were coming up to. You know, I just said that I read about 1970 and Annapurna. Nearly all Himalayan mountaineers nearing, Alaskan mountaineering, South American mountaineering, Patagonia, was heavyweight fixed rope expeditions using porters, high altitude using oxygen, taking many days. Importantly, they nearly always were from one nation. They were English, British expeditions. They were American expeditions. They weren't mixed expeditions like it is now. And by the early 70s, most of the major 8,000 meter peak, all the 8,000 meter peaks had been climbed, and quite a number of the significant peaks in the 7,000 meters had been climbed, again in South America and North America. And the last real hurrah of it was in 75 when Chris Bonington took a large heavyweight expedition to climb the southwest face of Everest. And that was really, certainly in Britain, the last big Himalayan expedition. And it was the end of an age. And my group of friends could see this and were building up to that to move on to the next level, which was to move from the heavyweight expeditions to using the same system that we'd been using for 4 or 5 years in the Alps, to go and use that same system in the Himalayas. In other words, what was christened alpine style. So alpine style meaning that you pack all your gear in your bag, and there's two or four of you, if it's in the case of the Himalayas, and you start at the bottom, you go to the top, and you come back down. And you don't have any extra, you know, you don't have people helping you. You don't have a, you know, you might have a couple of goes because the weather comes in, you come down and you go up again. But essentially, it is a fast and light. People say light in terms of an overall expedition. Because the actual rucksacks you're carrying are bloody heavy, as you know, you cram them full of perhaps 8 days' food and fuel to do it, and it's just massively. But the other important thing is, it was doable, because I would have had to wait all my life to be invited on one of these elite expeditions, whereas suddenly, if there was just two or four of you could go, you could buy a ticket, pack your gear in a few bags, and off you go to India or Nepal. So suddenly it became accessible. It became accessible also because the jumbo jet had been invented and airfare prices went down. Leica had started doing cheap fares. There was all sorts of things that went into it. But that mid-70s was the crucial time when we moved from heavyweight to alpine style in the Himalayas. Well, come on, we'll develop that in a minute, you know, later on, because also we thought it was safer to do that. Big mistake, but we thought that. So times were a changing, as Dylan said at the time.
Namaskaram, my name is Mayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
And so, you know, obviously, as you say, it was a watershed moment. It was pivotal. Everything was changing. As Mr. Average, as you put it, how were you getting involved in those dreams, you know, heading out east or to Alaska or wherever?
Well, by total coincidence, really, I do believe in chance and sliding doors in this world. That, you know, just, you know, you're wandering along and then something happens and it takes you in a wildly different direction than you ever anticipated or ever thought you could go. So when I went to university, I ended up sharing a room with a Liverpudlian guy called Nick Parry. And he was a climber as well. And his climbing mate, because he lived two doors down or three doors on the same street as him, was a guy called Alan Rouse. Now, Nick, my roommate, sort of became more interested in girls than climbing. And so Al went to Cambridge University. He was really incredibly clever, and it was pretty boring, the social life down there. So he used to hitch up to Leeds, and he would doss on our floor, and I would go climbing with him. Now, he was way, way better than me. You know, he'd been training since he was a lot younger on the Breck. You know, he'd been up and down every day, honing his finger strength, and he was so, so good. And yet, you know, he was totally happy to, you know, drink and get pissed and love life in Leeds. And then we used to go out climbing together. And in particular, there became a bond between him and John Syrett, because John Syrett was the best climber at Leeds at the time. And there was a sort of a rivalry. And particularly that would be, you know, shown on Joker's Wall at Brimham, where they tried and tried and tried to climb it. And eventually Syrett climbed it and Al didn't manage to climb it. But also at that time, as I say, things were changing. The story of John Syrett never climbed until he went to Leeds University. He was walking, he'd gone to a yoga lesson, which was very, very, very weird at that time, going to a yoga lesson. I mean, you know, it's very, very strange. Anyway, we'll leave that one. So he was walking along, and in this corridor, there was all these holds this wall with all these funny holes sticking out of it. And he wondered, what the hell's this? Anyway, a couple of days later, he walks past it. There's a guy called Don Robinson, and he was in the corridor by the wall. And John looked up at him and says, do you want to go? And John was a bit puzzled. Glad to go at what? It's a climbing wall. All right, have a go. So he had a go, and he was hooked, and he was on it every day. So John Syra, from not being a climber, went on a climbing wall. This was the first climbing wall in the world. Not only was it the first climbing wall in the world, but John Syra was the test pilot for this. He was the first person to go from being a non-climber to being an expert climber. And when he went out, he was suddenly climbing far better than the rest of us. And that is what the way now that large percentage of climbers, rock climbers, start climbing. But that, in 1969, was the birth of what we now have as an Olympic sport. And so our house was in lying on my floor, what we're going to do today. John Syra, John Stanford would come and knock on the door, and off we'd go. Meanwhile, like other coincidence and sliding doors or whatever, Al's roommate at Cambridge was a guy called Mick Geddes. Mick Geddes was a Scot, and we'll talk a little bit about Mick now. Mick probably was at that time, or would become, the best ice climber in the world, or certainly in Britain. By the time he got to university, by the age of 17, he was the youngest person to have done all the Munros, did most of them by himself. Not only had he done all the Munros, he'd done all the tops by then, which I still think might be a record, although all the research I can't find. So he was quite a wily guy. He was a very quiet guy. When he had a few drinks, he suddenly went a bit off on one. But, you know, it was a very... So Mick started coming up. And at Leeds, we started to get... We had this minivan in the winter. And we would leave for Scotland with it full on Thursday. Al and Mick used to arrive on Wednesday night, hitching up from Cambridge. We'd all jump into the van, go up to Scotland, climb, drive back, arrive back at Leeds on Monday. Al and Mick would then hitch back to Cambridge, get there on Tuesday, and then repeat the process next week. So I started climbing there with Mick Geddes. Now, Mick Geddes, people might argue with this, but he really was the main driving force of developing curved and front point traction PLA, in French, ice climbing. You know, for example, him and Al, on one of our trips up there, did the second ascent of Orion Face, the second ascent of -1 gully. Mick was the first person to climb a grade 6, I think, in Scotland. He single-handedly, McInnes, yeah, and Chouinard developed the tools. Mick was one of the main people who then used them to their absolute maximum. So I had these two characters, well, three characters, more than that. Certainly Al and Mick became my mates. They weren't older, they were the same age, but they were so much more talented than me. But some of it rubbed off. And so I was suddenly there with them. And of course, when we became dissatisfied and wanted to go away to the Alps, then that's what we did. So my progression I would not have progressed without those people. To put it short, really. And not only that, everybody else was feeding off themselves. So people like Roger Baxter Jones, who I was climbing with quite a bit, John Stainforth, and then John Whittle in Wales. So we formed this group. At that time, or just before that time, Lito Tejeras Flores had written this amazing article for the Sierra Club, which every climber should read, called Games Climbers Play. And what he defined, it was a set of games that climbers play. And you can really play anyone, but play any one of those games, but generally people start at the bottom and work their way up and stop at a certain point. And this is crucial from a number point of view, a number of reasons. Really, the first one being that it teaches you how to climb, and secondly, it teaches you about risk. So you start with bouldering, then you go on to single pitch rock climb, multi pitch rock climb, snow and ice climbing, alpine, and then into the Himalayas. And he divided Himalayas into that right at the last minute from Himalayan heavyweight to super alpinism. Okay, so super alpinism really was alpine style. And it's obvious that not very many people get killed bouldering, but quite a few people get killed in the Alps because there's crevasses, there's bad weather. And so as you go up that those games, more things can go wrong. And the objective dangers of the mountains increase. And it might be that some people just go to bouldering and climbing on Stanage, and that's it where it is. And they're very happy to do that. Absolutely great. You know, no problem. But his article, you know, was very definitive and helpful to sort of place people where they were. But we wanted to go up all the way up the ladder. You know, we'd suddenly gone to the Alps. The next thing that is not really mentioned is the Alps in winter. And we realized that we actually liked alpine climbing, but in the continent, the French and the Germans were starting to make a big deal that climbing in the Alps in winter was hardcore, was where the actual cutting edge of mountaineering was. At that time, before global warming, it was bloody cold. There was a lot of bad weather. It's a lot easier now. Not only that, the other factor is, in this period, we had no weather forecasts. Yeah, the weather forecast you got to go and climb was the one that was printed in the newspaper on that day, which was just a guess anyway. And so, you know, we started... We went out to the Alps in winter in 1974, I think, the first time, with Al Rouse and Rab Carrington. Rab was part of the team by then. So Al and Rab climbed together, and me and John Whittle climbed together. Then me and John and Mick Geddes, and then Roger Baxter Jones, and so we formed this core of people who were climbing in the Alps in winter. And there were other groups as well. I'm talking about my smallish group. But for example, at that time, Dick Renshaw and Joe Tasker were having similar thoughts and were in their own group. And, you know, we were really pissed off when we suddenly found they'd gone over to the Eiger and made the first winter British ascent of the Eiger. But they were on exactly the same trajectory as us, but in a slightly different bubble socially in the UK. But we're all doing it. And likewise, there's groups of Germans, like groups of Americans, doing the same thing. So the Alps in winter was a huge stepping stone, not only for fitness and knowledge-wise, but mentally. It really was the mental thing. You had to learn how to suffer. And at that time, we viewed the climbing that we were doing totally reliant as much as on getting fit, but for us to become adapted to the mountains, adapted to the dangers. And so we were sort of thinking along the lines of, in a very crude Darwinian way, the survival of the fittest. And I think that also, I mean, it had been a very natural, not natural, I suppose, in Victorian times, after we come from the romantics of Coleridge and Wordsworth and all those sort of people, we got into a group of people, explorers in Victorian times, who basically, I suppose, Nietzsche's quote, that which does not kill us makes us stronger, was a sort of an anthem of the day in Victorian times. And we were taking on that idea that by facing the danger, we would mentally become stronger. There's no way that you could just go from the couch to the north face of the Grand Jurassic in winter. just mentally, physically, anyway. You had to go in a series of steps. You had to get used to it. So we were very much into the idea that our training was adaptation at that time. And by adapting to the Alps in winter, it allowed us to think about going on our first expedition, my first expedition, which was to South America. So the South American expedition was born out of a group of us all just getting together and in a pub and getting drunk and thinking wildly and, you know, and suddenly coming up, well, let's go to South America. Let's go for 9 months because we can't afford going backwards and forwards. So we went to Patagonia, we went to Bolivia, we went to Peru. I remember we had to save up some money. I'd left university. I'd sort of left my girlfriend because she wanted to settle down and I didn't. And that was another issue, really. There's a lot of things saying, hey, you must, you know, the conventions that you had to do certain things, you know, you get a job, you get a house, you get married, you have children, you get a dog, you know, all these sort of things, which are all holding you down to the ground and stopping you going on doing your things. So I split up with my girlfriend, sadly, and whatever. Anyway, we saved money. I became a supply teacher. I was climbing with John Whittle. John Whittle was an artist. He was a philosopher, and he decided he was going to make the money for the trip by setting up a Punch and Judy show on Llandudno Beach. It didn't work, so we had to borrow the money. And even when we borrowed the money, we only had enough money to buy one-way tickets to South America. So off we went to South America, and there was Al Rouse and Rab Carrington, John Whittle and myself, and the Burgess twins, Alan and Adrian Burgess, who were all part of our group. And we climbed in Patagonia. Well, we climbed all over the place for 9 months. And that was our first expedition. But we were purely, you know, we took with us, you know, a couple of nine mil ropes and a rack and, you know, a set of boots, and that was it. You know, everything we carried was in one rucksack. And that was our first expedition, and that was all alpine style. The number of routes we did on that trip was just amazing. I mean, just like, I can't believe that we actually did what we did. And when we came back from that, of course, our minds, more than our bodies, our minds are totally into this. So off we go to the Himalayas.
But that, I mean, is amazing. I didn't know that. I didn't know you did 9 months. Because that's, I mean, it's the modern, you know, the modern dirt bags or the modern travelers. But I think to do it back then, to just pack a bag with some climbing gear and think, well, we'll work this out later, you know, coming home's kind of future Brian's problem. Did you just climb for 9 months?
Yeah. Yeah, well, obviously there was the travel in between the place, like all sorts of things happened. It's in the book, all right? You know, quite a lot of it, all this is in the book. But, for example, John and I were climbing Stannart. That was our objective, which hadn't been climbed. And eventually we got to within 3 meters of the summit of it, and then we're blown off the summit. So we couldn't actually claim it. So I got back down, and Bridwell had come to base camp, and he was looking for his gear, which he'd hidden somewhere in a pit in one of his episodes of not being quite in the real world, as he was a lot of the time. But I got to know him quite well. And John Whittle found out that a letter arrived, because communications was non-existent. When we went to Cherry Torry area, there was no village there. El Charlton did not exist. There was a dirt road and one little building for the park ranger. And so we went up into the woods, and we got letters sent in by the estancia driver going in there. And we had a camp in the woods. And anyway, finally, you know, like one of our, we got letters every month or something like that. And on one of the letters, it told us that two of our good friends in Bangor had been killed doing a winter ascent of the Matterhorn, and they were really good friends of John Whittle's, and also that Dougal Haston had been killed and avalanched, and John also had been a very good friend of Dougal Haston because he got to know him in the Alps in winter. And both of them, because of John's philosophical background, Haston was very interested in philosophy, and they spend a lot of time talking about philosophy. And this destroyed John. He said, "I'm leaving." So he just packed up his bags and left. So I was left by myself because, you know, there was three pairs. And so I ended up going off with a guy called Mike Weiss. And we went up, we got a boat from Punta Arenas to Puerto Montt, and then we climbed a volcano called Acerno, then Aconcagua. And then we met the others at in Buenos Aires. And then we went, caught the train up to La Paz, and we climbed in the Cordillera Real, and I did a new route with Bridwell. It's quite funny because it was the first time Bridwell had put on crampons. And the top bit, I said, "Let's go and solo this." He said, yeah, man, let's do all it. Yeah, it's great. And off he went. And it was good. It was quite a natural climber going up. But when he came to come down, because he hadn't climbed on crampons before, he couldn't descend. It was horrendous. And we'd left the rope behind. anyway, we did this new route. We got back down again. Then I went up to Peru, and we did some big routes in the Cordillera Blanca. Al and Rab were in the Wiwash, and they did their amazing three big climbs, which are, you know, most of them haven't been repeated on Rasac. So we were doing a lot of climbs. I gave a lecture two nights ago, and Rab was at the lecture, and he reminded me that we finished this by, I borrowed money. We flew back to Zurich Airport, went straight to Chamonix, and started climbing in Chamonix the next day, me and Rab. So climbing was running in our blood, should we say.
But it sounds like it has for your entire life. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and just sort of, you know, reading the notes before we started talking about all this, you know, you've talked about the new book and, you know, you've called it High Risk, Climbing to Extinction. And obviously you've just mentioned that, you know, a couple of people have been killed and, you know, it's always awful bringing the tone down like this, but I'm curious as to specifically why you chose that title and what was it that made you think like that, I guess.
Right. Well, okay. So we all went to the whole group in different ways, started going to the Himalayas. So I went to Janu with Rab and Al and Roger Baxter-Jones, then Nupsi, new route on Nupsi with Doug Scott, George Bettenberg, Al Rouse and myself. I'm the only survivor of that. You know, this is where you start getting the idea of the four of us on Janu. There's only me and Rab left. I went to Baltorak Hengri, and that was a ski trip, skied down from the summit of that, and then the Yoga to Makalu, et cetera, et cetera, and finally on K2. Now, when I say finally, because to me that's where a full stop happens for my Himalayan climbing in 1986. So really this book is about from 1970 to 1986, okay? So up until 1980, hey, this alpine style stuff is great, it's brilliant. You know, it's safer, we're going when we want, it's cheaper, it's absolutely great. You know, successful, nobody's dying. It's and that was the same for, you know, Mesner and Michael Kennedy in the States and Jeff Lowe and all the French guys who were so brilliant as well. And of course the Poles, Wojtek Kurtyka in particular, who had by chance joined up with Alex McIntyre to start climbing. Alex was one of the guys at Leeds as well. You know, Alex possibly more than any drove this alpine style forward. But round about 1980, a few people started to die, and that became more and more. And we started looking. You see, one of the reasons why we thought alpine style was better was because you're in less danger. If you think about it, on an expedition, say to Bonington's last expedition to the southwest face of Everest. There might have been 15 people on it. And they were climbing for over a two-month period. So, well, say they all went on the hill for like 30 or 40 days, 15 times 30 is a lot of man days to be exposed to the mountains. Take our trip to Jannu, there's four of us, and we're on the mountain on Jannu for 8 days. So a hell of a lot of less man days against the actual objective dangers of the mountains. The mountains have no consciousness, you know, they every day that they're alive, they're avalanching and snow coming down and boulders coming in. It's us that goes there and has to, the danger is only ours, not the mountains. And so we thought, well, this is obvious why. But then this accident's happened and we started questioning, you know, why this is. And it was only really when I wrote the book that I came to analyze a lot of things. And it was a really deep, it took 3 years of thinking. And so one of the first things I did, I sort of looked at the people who died and the number of expeditions I went on and the number of people I went on and did the statistics. And I found out that in that period of time, I had a 1 in 6 chance of dying. Okay. Which is the same as Russian roulette. To give you a bit of context, in the Battle of Somme in the First World War, the risk of dying is 1 in 10. Okay, the worst really was the Second World War British Bomber Command, where it is 1 in 2. But of course, in the Somme and the air crews, they had no choice. We had a choice. Whatever the chances are, you know. And then there's a lot of other figures, you know. The most dangerous mountain in the world is Annapurna, so certainly at that time, for every 3 people who stand on the summit, 1 person dies. Everest at that time was 1 to 10, although it's about 1 in 100 now. So let's, all these figures are just, you know, in here or out the other, but so it's dangerous, we have to say. So what could we do about it? And we well thought, by going out more, as I said, we'd get this Darwinian adaption. But what we didn't realize is there's a feedback. It's a circular sort of thing. Because as we get better, our brains say, hey, we can do something harder, longer. We can do something that's technically steeper. And by doing so, it became more dangerous. And so as we became more adapted, we did harder things, which cancelled out the adaption. And so this idea that we had was, you know, was not true, really. And like, there's a big argument that happened a few years ago between Ed Viesters in the States, who wrote a book saying that exactly that he was safer than other people in the mountains because he was so good, he was so adapted. Dave Roberts, mountaineer, author, he's recently died, said, no, it's pure chance. It's absolutely a lottery going into the mountains. You will die when, you know, just chance, the throw of the dice. And so going through my book and looking and analysing it, I changed my mind through what I thought. In my 20s, I didn't think I was going to die. It was going to happen to somebody else. But I changed my mind as I realised writing the book, as I got older, and as you get older and all these anchors in the ground from your getting married and houses, you become more aware of your mortality, that it's pure luck whether you survive. And the more you go, the more likely you are you're going to die. And we were going on 3 and 4 expeditions a year then, where the old timers before in the 60s were only going on, it took 2 years to organize an bloody expedition, you know. So we were going more often and climbing harder routes. So we were aware. I've got somewhere written down here, one of the great quotes, a very short one, was by Al Rouse, actually, after he soloed the boulders in 1970. He said, 15 minutes on the thin red line is worth an awful lot of ordinary living. And that really shows the, you know, how Al Rouse viewed viewed the whole thing, really.
It's so interesting, though. Like, I'd love to get philosophical about it. We probably don't have time, but we could a little bit. I think, you know, that quote from Al is amazing, but he died in the mountains, didn't he?
Al died in the mountains, yeah, for sure. And it really was a case of, you know, an accident waiting to happen, really. I mean, nearly all the expeditions in that period, people were dying. You know, Joe Tasker and Pete Boardman died. Pete Exton died. Paul Nunn, one of my friends, died later. Roger Baxter Jones, he was just guiding on the Triolet in the Argentia Basin, and a Serac collapsed and wiped him out. So there's so many people who were dying just for, you know, why? And I started then becoming more philosophical before, but thinking about my own mortality. And I went to, we organized a trip to K2, which Al Rouse was the leader. And Al by that time was not the same Al that I knew earlier on. He was more competitive. He was more aware that he wanted to be the next Chris Bonington of British mountaineering. And he felt as though he wanted to establish himself as the best mountaineer of the time, whereas lots of other people, you know, were more just happy to do their own thing and climb, people like myself or Rab. But Al was wanting to turn it more into a proper career. And he was in a weird battle, I would say, with Joe Tasker and Pete Boardman at that time, who were also in that frame of mind. Of course, they died. And in 86, really, Al was the, you know, in line to do that. He was doing a lot of good things. But also he felt that if he made the first British ascent of K2, because it hadn't been climbed by a Brit at that time, then that would really cement his reputation, because at that time people like Doug Scott and Chris Bonington were slowly, you know, getting a little bit older and not quite as ambitious, and you know, that was very, very important. And we'd been given permission to climb the Northwest Ridge, which is 2 days' walk away from base camp, and that was far. It was the wrong route to do in lightweight style, and we got bogged down. And we, I had hurt my leg in a skiing accident, and I had to go home early. It turned out to snap my cruciate, and then two or three of the other expedition left. John Porter left, and then it was decided that we abandon the route and all go home. But Al said, "No, I want to stay. I want to have one last chance and try an alpine ascent of the Abruzzi." And he teamed up with a group of people going up there because he wanted to climb. He was obsessed. The word is obsession. He was obsessed by mountaineering. And he went up there and he was caught in a storm. And he's still up there. He made the first ascent. And he was also partly paranoid because Julie Tullis was also in that team of people. And she would have not only been the first British person to climb K2, but the first British woman. And Al really didn't want that to happen. He wanted to be the first. And so there is competition in climbing, for sure. people do compete. But tragically, well, in some senses, happily, both got to the summit, and tragically, both of them died. And of interest, Marufka was one of the other parties, and of interest to this debate that's going on at the moment about Hillary, the American woman who's just died on Manaslu skiing, and whether women should climb, you know, with children. Both Julie Tullis and Marufka had two children, and that was before Alison Hargreaves died on K2. With two children. So, you know, it's just happening again, the big debate about children and women. But it was happening in 86 and whatever, you know.
But also, you know, I mean, I think I was going to say this isn't the place. Maybe this is the perfect place to get these opinions out. If we're going to have that conversation, and I say this because I fundamentally believe it, we should have the conversation on whether or not it's okay to climb as a parent. You know, it's just insane that people are talking about the difference between men and women and having kids and going mountaineering. It's madness. You know, I've got a friend who I shouldn't name, and I'll let her say it if she wants to on this sort of platform. She's a fairly well-known climber. And she says the question isn't why aren't more women climbing hills? The question is why do men feel the need to, you know, the big hills? And that's, it's a good question. But
yeah.
I, you know, and you, as you've alluded to, you know, you chilled out your kind of greater ranges stuff, and that happens in the book, which, you know, we'll leave people to read that. But I, you know, to sort of start to wrap this up, at the start of this conversation, you mentioned post-traumatic stress and PTSD. Do you think that's something that you suffer from or have suffered from as a result of your experiences in the mountains?
I have suffered from them, but I mean, there's several forms of post-traumatic stress, and there's post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a lot more serious, and that's when, rather than the standard post-traumatic stress, which is really a reaction, a natural reaction in your body, it's almost obvious that if you see somebody die, then it's going to affect you, and post-traumatic stress is actually the rebalancing in our brain and our body to accept that, which might take a few days, a few months or whatever. And I've had that experience both when I've had an accident or I've seen somebody die, but it hasn't affected me to such an extent that it's made me ill. It stopped me wanting to climb for a while and recalibrate myself until I've got used to it, but it hasn't made me ill. So yes, but I think that what you say about the female, the parenting side of things, is absolutely, the question is parenting, not whether you're a mother or a father, and I just view them as anchors. And if you throw that anchor out, and you're a parent, and that anchor doesn't stop you going, then fair enough, it's nothing wrong with it. But a lot of people in their 30s start to get responsibilities, and one of the key responsibilities is looking after children. And I remember, John Porter, who I climbed with an awful lot, he was staying with me last night, and he had a really fantastic quote, an observation more than a quote. He says, well, you know, I realized my time really of climbing in the mountains, high mountains, was up when I started hearing my two daughters' voices when I was on a bivouac shouting, Daddy, Daddy.
Yeah, that'll do it.
And as soon as that happened, he knew that he couldn't go into the greater ranges. Now, if men, women, anybody goes into the mountains, and you know, if those things start to happen to you, they are messages that perhaps indicate that, you know, you should not give up, but lower your horizons or do different things which you might think about as being safer. But I think that one of the things that I found was the fact when I've written this book that however expert you are, or however a novice you are, you have the same, in many ways, you have the same chance of having an accident or death. And that was particularly related to a lot of research that's been done in on avalanches onto heuristic risks. So heuristics are, you probably know what heuristics are, but some of the listeners might not do, but they are the body's short, the mental shortcuts on daily decisions. And some of the most relevant ones that we do really define what we do in the mountains. And big research has been done in avalanche statistics. And basically, they found out that a person going into avalanche terrain or a skier, first time, a novice, has as much chance of dying or being caught in the avalanche as an expert who's been doing it for so long. And that is because experts, mountaineers as well as avalanche, fall into heuristic traps. And I'm going to read a few, might be coming to the end of it, but just read a few of these heuristic traps. So the one of them is called familiarity. In other words, I've done it before. Okay. Consistency. I'll do it the same way as the last time. Acceptance. Fitting in with the social scene or norm. All my mates are doing it. Expert halo. I know the best. I'm a leader. Social. Other people have done it, therefore so can I. Scarcity. We have good weather forecast. We must use it. Or it's our last day of the holiday. We must do it. Okay. And then there's several other things affect our decision making. One is optimistic bias. This is where you think another person's risk is greater than yours, which is quite a natural thing. And then false sense of control. The more you think you're in control, the less worried you are. And then the final one, which you will empathize with being a filmmaker, outside pressure, reward versus risk, sponsorship, filming, peer pressure, sponsors, demands. Now, all of those go into the mix, and it really just shows that you don't have to be an expert to die in the mountains, and you don't have to be a novice to die in the mountains. And there's another quote from a PGHM, one of the heads of PGHM in Grenoble, who says, if anybody thinks that all the accidents that we pick up from the slopes of the French mountains are novices and beginners, then they're severely wrong. Most of them are good climbers.
So given all of that, you know, it's fascinating, the statistics and obviously the traps. Given all of that, would you encourage someone in their early 20s who loves rock climbing to start climbing in the bigger hills?
Yes, absolutely. Because certainly for me, it has given me a fantastic life that I would not really change. Well, I'd love that my mates were still here having pints who are dead. And I've been into situations where I felt I was going to die and I've had very hard times. But overall, my experiences in life, I feel, have enriched my life massively. And I think that the further you go up the games climbers play, the bigger the rewards as well as the bigger the risks. So it's just a matter of balancing reward and risk. And when you feel as though they're unbalanced, in other words, there's too much risk, then that's the time to get out. And I didn't realise that. In 1986, I walked away from K2 having a horrendous time. When I got back to Britain, I thought, God, I want to go climbing again. I want to go out to the Himalayas again. And I went out to the Himalayas again, and I couldn't climb. I hated it. And then I came back, and I want to go out again. I did that three times. And it wasn't until 2000, when I went out to K2 a final time, that finally I had closure. I was working on a film, so I wasn't actually climbing, but I hated it. I hated it because of all the memories there. And that was closure. And I decided never to climb in the Himalayas Himalayas again, in the big mountains. But before that, in the period between 1986 and 2000, I was in limbo. I was in this madhouse in my head that I wanted to climb. And when I tried it, I was rock climbing okay. I was climbing in the Alps okay. As guide and whatever, but proper big mountains where, you know that your life is on the line. You have to have the right head to do it. And, you know, the main thing it gives you is the journey. And my final thing I'd say is that is absolutely key. And all this nonsense of people hiring guides and climbing Everest by a fixed rope from base camp to the summit with 8 liters per hour of oxygen being pumped into them, and all their bags carried, all their meals cooked, is not a journey. It's a person going on an ego trip to totally goal driven, which is against everything that I would stand for in mountaineering and think it's crazy. But that's a complete different. Ready conversation.
I was going to ask you, but you said it so succinctly and eloquently. I mean, it's clear where you stand. And, you know, it is a big debate. It's a question I've asked a lot of people and it's deeply personal, but it's quite obvious that, you know, I totally get why you feel the way you do. I won't say which camp I sit in. I think it's probably obvious. but yeah, amazing. I mean, we're slightly over time, so I'll just, you know, I always end these conversations by asking two questions, if you don't mind. The first is, what scares you?
Claustrophobia.
In what context?
I like open air, and I don't like being oppressed by lots of people around me with no escape out. I've been caving. I can cave. It's not that sort of claustrophobia. It's almost human claustrophobia that scares me.
That's interesting. I'm glad I dug. What brings you hope?
Oh, the new generation of people who are. A lot of my book and a lot of what we talked about is doom and gloom, but in actual fact, although mountaineering now in many people's eyes is the 90% of people who are guided up Everest or Mont Blanc, there is another 10% of people who are young climbers developing, as I did, mostly, but not often, starting on a climbing wall wherever. And they're probably similar in number, but not in proportion, who are doing the most amazing new routes, generally on the 6,000 and 7,000 metre peaks in the world, and totally under the radar. And what's great is most of them are accepting that it's totally under the radar. You know, they wanted to be under the radar, because if they suddenly start shouting about it, they involve this other circus that's going on with all these amazing trips. And one of my most beautiful times in the mountains in my life was that I'd cherish was when I climbed Nupsi. We went into the Western Coombe, and it was in the autumn, and there was nobody else there, apart from Doug Scott, George Bettenberg, Al Rouse and myself. And we're walking down with all these amazing mountains, and we're the only people there. And I cherish that time. It was just a cathedral, a beautiful cathedral. And yet, like 3 or 4 years later, I was asked if I would guide Everest. And it was for quite a lot of money. And I refused, because it would have destroyed that moment. I couldn't have gone back there again because of that most amazing moment, which is etched in my memory.
Fascinating and amazing. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
Okay then, Matt. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk or follow along on Instagram at theadventurepodcast. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft, produced by Ola Omori, and if you want to get in touch, you can do so at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.